Hello from Washington. I would like to welcome everyone who's joining us on this briefing call. I am Ori Neer, spokesman of Americans for Peace Now. And from Jerusalem, joining us is Danny Zeidman. He is the founder of Ir Amim, an Israeli organization concerned with the future of Jerusalem. Danny is widely recognized as the foremost expert on Jerusalem, on municipal operations in Jerusalem, on planning, resource allocation, residency rights, and property management. He's appeared before the Supreme Court in Israel on numerous occasions on Jerusalem-related land issues. As a former reporter who covered Jewish-Arab relations in Jerusalem, I can tell you that he is the source for the media on these issues. I will have a short conversation with Danny to explore the chief issues on our agenda relating to Jerusalem, and it will be followed by a Q&A session. With a new mayor in Jerusalem who has just concluded the U.S. tour, and with an Israeli government headed by a prime minister who in the past has lit fires in Jerusalem, and with a U.S. administration that has now signaled it is serious about Jerusalem and it takes the issue very seriously, are we heading toward a confrontation between the U.S. and the new Israeli government on Jerusalem?
My guess is that we should hold on to our seats. I certainly would not rule out that possibility. Let's take a look at precedent. When Shamir led a right-wing government in Israel, Teddy Kollek, who was our mythological mayor, had something of a moderating impact. And when Olmert, who was at that point quite right-wing, was elected mayor, Rabin tempered Olmert's policies, and so did Barak with Olmert. The most dangerous time in Jerusalem in recent memory was when we had pre-reformed Olmert as mayor and Netanyahu as prime minister. We had the Hasmonean Tunnel, the outbreak of violence, Ras al-Amud, Har Choma, settlements, etc., because there were no checks and balances. Mr. Barakat, the new mayor of Jerusalem, is new in office, but his record in recent months is a serious cause of concern. He's not an ideologue, but he has clearly linked himself and committed himself to the inflammatory settler agenda. And Mr. Netanyahu is also deeply committed to the myth of undivided Jerusalem that will never be redivided and staunch support for the settlers. This is clearly in conflict with the messages that are being sent and apparently not yet appreciated from the Obama administration.
Why do you find that Mayor Barakat is a serious source of concern?
Well, it's interesting. Mayor Barakat was something of the darling of Israeli secularists, and he is clearly not cut out of the cloth of the messianic ideologues of Atiret Kohanim or Elad settler organizations or their like. He's a technocrat. But even before the elections, he linked his political fate with those of the settlers. And we looked askance at this, but we said, well, let's see what's he going to do. Unfortunately, he's been as good as his word. I would say the following. Those who work closely with Mr. Barakat, number one, say he has a deep belief in his own ability and himself, doesn't doubt much, and believes that when he adopts a certain policy, everything will be fine if he just is perseverant. And even without being an ideologue, he has grafted the right-wing settler ideology into his operating system. It's more appropriate to talk about Mr. Barakat in terms of Windows XP than the Bible.
Because of his background in high-tech?
Exactly. But the bottom line is that the result is very similar. It is a devout dedication to settler activities, reduction of the Palestinian presence. And he's even been speaking about turning the old city in Silwan into Disneyland. This would have its humorous elements if it weren't so dangerous.
He really talked about turning the old city in Silwan into what would that mean? What did he mean by that?
Well, we have been watching with growing consternation an increasing settler presence, which informs the public domain, particularly in Silwan, but also elsewhere.
And let's just explain what Silwan is in a nutshell.
Silwan is a 29-acre ridge of land just to the south of the old city, which is indeed biblical Jerusalem even more than the Old City. It's here where the city of David indeed developed, to the extent that David was an historical figure, but it was clearly biblical Jerusalem. It's one of the, it's the cradle of Jewish civilization. It's enormously important. It's also a Christian site. It's where the New Testament has Jesus healing the blind, and it's a Muslim site as well. This has been the target of settler activities, and the municipal and governmental plans include turning this into sort of an ersatz biblical realm, sort of a biblical Williamsburg, Virginia, with moving stairs going through the most important archaeological site in Israel and perhaps on the planet, with a cable car going from Silwan to the Mount of Olives and to Abu Tor. And initially we looked at this and said, my goodness, this has some of the trappings of a Jewish evangelical theme park, and we were told, don't be so snarky and demagogical. Your case is very compelling without that. Well, in recent weeks, Mr. Barkat has been telling everybody who's willing to listen, I'm going to turn Silwan, the old city, into Disney World. And, you know, here you think you are being demagogical, and then reality zips by you, waves, and looks at you in the rearview mirror, and you're sort of looking, you know, look aghast at this. This not only undermines the religious and cultural integrity of the city, which is enormously important. Jerusalem is not Jerusalem without the compatibility of the competing narratives of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It is enormously dangerous. Jerusalem is a very delicate ecosystem. And those who pay reverence to the complexity of Jerusalem know how to handle it responsibly, and then Jerusalem is a very stable city. Those who ignore the complexity and turning this into a theme park certainly does that, is almost a guaranteed conflagration, and when Jerusalem erupts, it sends seismic tremors throughout the region.
I know that you like to talk about Jerusalem having its own sort of built-in systems of checks and balances. You mentioned earlier your concern that this government may not have such checks and balances. But we do have labor in this government, headed by Ehud Barak. Would labor, do you think labor might serve as the kind of checks and balances that you're looking for?
Well, my immediate response is, come on. But that's unfair. I mean, for example, there are members of Barkat's coalition, even from the Likud party, in positions of authority who are attentive and responsible, listening to us and taking responsible action. We should not write off anybody. And by the way, we should not write off Mr. Barkat and even Netanyahu. They can be persuaded and they can be socialized. It may be difficult, but it's possible. We will be addressing all of the partners. Our experience in the past is that the Labour Party has never allowed its party platform or Mr. Barak's willingness to engage in the political division of Jerusalem to really influence their daily management of these crises. So I am not optimistic, but we are clearly resolved to exhaust these possibilities and talk sense to whoever is willing to listen to us.
When Secretary Clinton was in Israel, she talked about home demolition in Jerusalem as being a problem. What did that indicate to you?
Well, it's interesting. There are differing interpretations on this. First of all, she arrived in the wake of municipal announcements of an intention to pursue massive demolitions in the Silwan area, clearly motivated.
And Danny, maybe we should just explain that Silwan is, in modern times today, is an Arab-Palestinian
Absolutely.
Neighborhood. It's a little village of sorts. Right.
It's Silwan. All of Silwan is 30,000 residents. The El Khilwa area has about 4,000 residents, and it's a contemporary neighborhood village of Jerusalem. Now, when the settlers uncover our Jewish past, that excites me very much, but it doesn't blind me to the contemporary realities of a vibrant Palestinian community living there who are being threatened. They're being threatened by takeover of their properties by legal and illegal means. They're being threatened by an ideologically, messianically motivated planning regime, and they're being threatened by demolitions. That was the context of the Clinton visit. These came to light shortly before her visit, and actually on the very day that she met with Barakat, new demolition orders were handed down, which was a bit of in your face. The Palestinians interpreted Hillary Clinton's remark to the effect that housing demolitions are not helpful, which is a bit tepid. I mean, my mother-in-law is also not helpful for the peace process, but never mind. Having said that, she made it very, very clear that she viewed these not as a municipal issue, but as a political one. She was quite adamant. She made her message loud and clear, and I think roughly interpreted that message was, don't mess with us on Jerusalem. Now, all indications are that the Secretary of State made her first visit to Israel with every intention of this not being a confrontational visit. And yet she felt herself compelled, through no fault of her own, to challenge a very inflammatory policy of Israel. I think that is unfortunate that this was necessary, but it augurs well for the kind of crisis management we may come to anticipate from the administration in Washington.
So let me now take you from the walls of the Old City in Silwan to another point of contention and potential problem known as E1. Now, this is the corridor that leads from Jerusalem to the settlement of Maale Adumim in the West Bank, and it's a problematic area, and you'll explain in a moment why it is problematic. There were reports in the Israeli press that the coalition agreement between Likud and Israel Beiteinu, Avigdor Lieberman's party, that those verbal understandings, not written, said that there will be construction in that corridor. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate, could you explain what's happening there?
Okay. Well, let me try and visually, if it's possible via a conference call, to describe what we're talking about. If you could imagine the Old City being the center of a face of a clock, Maale Adumim, which is one of the largest settlements in the West Bank, is due east of Jerusalem, about 7 or 8 miles, at 3 o'clock. E1 is the 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock quadrant between East Jerusalem and Maale Adumim, 12 square kilometers in the West Bank. Now, when I consider E1 to be a strategic threat to the very existence of Israel as a Jewish state as we know it, it derives from the following. If E1 will be built, two things will be achieved. Number one, it will dismember the Palestinian state into cantons, a northern canton and a southern canton, with one of Ramallah and Nablus and the other Bethlehem and Hebron, with no natural contiguity between the two of them, number one. And number two, it will seal East Jerusalem from its environs in the West Bank under the assumption that in the absence of a geographical connection between a future Palestinian state and East Jerusalem, there'll be no political connection as well. Now, if you believe that that the Palestinians ultimately, when the time comes, will ever accept a dismembered Bantustan, cantonized state, no, E1's not a problem. If you believe that Israel will arrive at peace and maintain exclusive control over Jerusalem, fine. We believe otherwise. We believe that if E1 will be built, such a mass of critical facts on the ground will be created as to make the two-state solution almost impossible. And making the two-state solution almost impossible means we're killing the one possible solution to the conflict. There is no other.
Hence
one-state solution is a consequence.
Yeah, hence the threat to the future of not only the Palestinian state, but Israel, the Jewish.
Absolutely. I mean, I wrote an article back in 4 years ago when E1 was being built illegally in the Washington Post, basically accusing the Bush administration of being anti-Israel because friends don't let friends drive drunk. And letting Israel build E1 is letting Israel doing something that is tantamount to self-destruction. As a result of that, the Clinton administration read Israel the Riot Act, and Netanyahu did not build E1. And even Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Elliot Abrams said to Sharon and Olmert, you're not to build E1, and they abided by that. Now, both Netanyahu and Lieberman are committed to building E1, and there's already a public campaign, billboards outside the area of E1, you know, publicizing, advertising the new neighborhood. This is going to be a major test. Now, you will not be surprised that neither Netanyahu nor Lieberman fill me in on their secret discussions. And I can't tell you what kind of credibility there is to these reports. But I know that E1 is clearly signaled as one of the potential collisions between the Obama administration and Netanyahu. By the way, it should not be the exclusive one. The position of the Bush administration is, hey, we stopped E1. We did our good deed for the second term of the Bush administration. Now we can go home. There are a couple of two or three other E1s out there. But this should be a clear litmus test as to where we're going. We will not be sucker punched on E1. We will be able to give friends of Israel about a six-month warning. It's not going to happen overnight. It means that we must be vigilant on this issue. But I must say, I am not hysterical over the issue. Let's put it this way. If two Renaissance men like George W. Bush and Ariel Sharon were capable and wise enough to stop E1, I think that perhaps even the benighted like President Obama should be able to handle it as well.
Danny, very shortly before we open the conversation to questions from participants on this call, I'd like to ask you to talk, if you will, about other potential sources of trouble in Jerusalem, other than the area of Silwan and this corridor between Jerusalem and Maale Adumim that you just spoke about.
Well, I think that what we are witnessing partially derives from positive developments. You know, 7 years ago, Olmert was almost a devout Jesuit when it came to the indivisibility of Jerusalem, and he now concedes as well that Jerusalem must be divided. There's a good deal of cognitive convergence. Israelis and Palestinians more or less know where the border between Israel and Palestine will be. It will be somewhere between the Green Line and the separation barrier. As a result of that, the conflict is being reduced to its volcanic core. And what's happening in Silwan is perhaps the major battlefield, but it is not the theater of war. The theater of war is the old city and the historic basin around the old city, no more than 4 square miles. And there are dangerous trends afoot that aspire to turn over the critical sites in these areas to the extreme settler organizations, establishing the hegemony of a particularly exclusionary Jewish presence that does not pay reverence either to the Christian or the Muslim sites or to the presence of a vibrant Palestinian community there. This has been going on for about 3 or 4 years, but we are only now seeing it come to fruition. The potential of this, I would say, as follows. First of all, if these trends continue, Jerusalem will indeed erupt. I can't tell whether that will be 3 weeks from now or 3 years from now, but this is precisely the kind of event, the threat, real or purported, and there are some real threats out there to sacred space, that causes Jerusalem to erupt. And when it does, Jerusalem's eruptions send tremors throughout the region. When I discussed this with a member of the Jordanian royal court, his response was, oh, Danny, it's really nice of you to come visit me here in Amman, because if these trends continue, you might be visiting me soon in London, because that's where we Hashemites are going to be. These are precisely the kinds of actions, irresponsible actions, that undermine the legitimacy and ultimately the stability of the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. The second implication of this goes even further. You know, for as grim as circumstances are, and indeed they are grim, we Israelis and Palestinians are still holding on to a nasty, bloody, but political conflict, a national political conflict that's sometimes fueled by the fumes of volatile gases of religious fundamentalism. Because it's a political conflict, it is manageable by mortals and ultimately resolvable by the tools of diplomatic craftsmanship. What we are seeing taking place in and around the old city of Jerusalem threatens to transform the nasty political conflict, which ultimately can be resolved, into a completely insoluble, you know, Armageddon playground. You know, Milchemet Mitzvah, Jihad, Holy War, Armageddon, Second Coming, hopefully in that order. At which point we can all pack our bags and go home, which is fine for you guys, but I am home, and this is... If I understand the Obama administration, they're looking at some kind of realignment or new kind of terms of reference with the Arab world and with the Islamic world in ways that are not hostile to an Israeli interest. I think that if current trends continue or are accelerated in and around the old city, this is precisely the kind of thing that could undermine the efforts of the Obama administration, not only on the Israeli-Palestinian track, but in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and elsewhere, because these issues rock. And the issues that I'm talking about are literally wind in the sails of Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Hamas, and others who seek to transform our conflict into a religious one, and we have to resist that at all costs.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. This is John in South Portland, Maine. Building on what you said about Obama, do you think there's any possibility of getting him to stop aid to Israel if, say, they build E1 or under any other circumstances?
No, I don't think that that's necessary, and I don't think it's helpful. I think that there are ways in which the administration can engage without using, without bludgeoning Israel.
Or threatening to.
Look at what happened during the Bush administration. It took a year, perhaps, but the Bush administration finally was convinced that building E1 would undermine President Bush's vision of a two-state solution, perhaps destroy it. There was no food fight. There was no blood on the walls. He expressed in no uncertain terms, in ways that are the details of which are not known publicly or known to me, that the President of the United States views this as national interest of the United States, and that is not something that an Israeli Prime Minister can ignore. And lo and behold, the ceiling didn't fall in. Not one hair fell out of Olmert's head. There was no firestorm in Washington from AIPAC, and there was no strain in the bilateral relations. Believe me, when the President of the United States decides to engage on an issue, he does not require a massive artillery bombardment.
Thank you.
This is David Cooper from Berkeley, California. I actually went to camp with Danny 40
years ago. Voice of Christmas past.
Yeah, really. I'm also a friend of Alan Solomano, so... I was wondering if you know what's happening with the Museum of Tolerance at this point, and is there any chance to stop that anymore?
Danny, just maybe in a nutshell explain what the Museum of Tolerance is for the benefit of people.
The Simon Wiesenthal Center of Los Angeles, which I consider to be a very respectable, incredible organization, years back decided to build a Tolerance Museum in Jerusalem, which I actually think is a pretty good idea. But unfortunately, they were shunted off in the direction of building this museum on the site of the most important historic Muslim cemetery in Jerusalem, the Memela Cemetery. All the plans have proceeded, have been approved, and when the excavations began, skeletons were found. You know, there were hundreds, perhaps thousands of graves uncovered, and there was quite an uproar. The matter was taken to the Israeli Supreme Court. I appeared before the Supreme Court in an amicus suit supported by some of the finest Mideast experts in Israel, people like Shimon Shamir and one of the Israel Prize winner Yoshua Ben-Aryeh. But the court ruled that all of the technical formalities have been fulfilled and this was not going to be stopped by legal means. It is now proceeding. Now, I don't believe this is over, but it is very, very late in the day. There is increasing awareness in Israel that regardless of the formal legality, it is simply not possible to build a tolerance museum by desecrating the memories of Muslims in the city of Jerusalem, or Jews for that matter. One can imagine what would happen if a tolerance museum were to have been built on the Mount of Olives. Now, as a rule, I am very reluctant to embroil the American Jewish community in issues, domestic issues in Israel. But clearly, this is the quintessential example in which there's a major role to be played in the Tolerance Museum, because this is a project of the American Jewish community. I mean, the keynote speaker at the groundbreaking ceremony was Governor Schwarzenegger. We believe that building the Tolerance Museum is, number one, going to cause a festering sore in the heart of Jerusalem, achieve precisely the opposite of its intended goal in tolerance, and will be boycotted by anybody to whom actual tolerance is dear to them. And we have been appealing, both here in Israel and in North America, to the Wiesenthal Center, look, guys, we're not against you or your message, but holding on to this project when, you know, have you no sense of irony? We will help move it a mile away, a mile and a half away, and there are places available. Don't do this. So it's late in the day, and whatever support we can get from the American Jewish community would be very, very welcome to talk sense into people. I don't think that there was anything sinister in their choosing this site. I think they were misled. I do think that they have made a major mistake by not cutting their losses and moving elsewhere.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll see you when I come to Israel.
I certainly look forward to it.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, Everett Mendelson calling.
Hello, Everett.
Hi, Danny. How are you? The query I have has to do with the history that we look at in the building of settlements in the West Bank and in Jerusalem. Criticisms are raised. There's a little bit of muted saying, well, we'll pull back a little, we'll slow down, we won't build right there. And yet the history has been that steps continue to be made, new settlements built. And I wonder, as you look at these sensitive areas in Jerusalem, are we apt to see the same thing occurring? And that is objection. There may even be a slight backtracking on Silwan, but at the end of the day, we'll see a slow building or a slow change in the way that things are being handled.
I think what you're describing is quite possible, and I think the issue that you're raising is extremely topical. I mean, it is my dubious honor probably to go into the Guinness Book of Records on how many times we've killed E1.
Mm-hmm.
E1 is never killed. We haven't discovered the kind of stake to drive through the heart of this vampire. These plans merely become dormant and then come back again. The dividends accrued to Israel today by building settlements in East Jerusalem are minimal. They do not address any of the problems of the city. The damage done to the credibility of the process and the possibility of the two-state solution and the viability and stability of Jerusalem are inordinate. I would caution very much against going down this back alley of natural growth and within places that are likely and things of that nature. I think that the lessons of the Oslo years should be, it is impossible to have a credible political peace process with terror in the background and incitement, but it is also impossible to negotiate borders and the status of Jerusalem in good faith and simultaneously dictate the outcome of those negotiations by means of earth-moving equipment. Can't be done. And the message is, if Israel is serious about negotiating an agreement, regardless of what one's position is on where the border should be precisely, if we're serious about that, there has to be zero tolerance for settlement expansion in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Without quibbling, without ifs, without buts, zero tolerance.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, this is Jim Vitarello in Washington. How are you, Ori, and how are you, Danny?
Pretty well. How are you?
By the way, Danny, I just heard one of your people with Air Amin, Sarah Kramer.
Yes.
Gave a wonderful PowerPoint presentation this morning about this and other Jerusalem issues at J Street. And she was terrific, and I really like that booklet you guys put out, too, on Jerusalem.
Thank you.
It's terrific. Anyway, here's my question about this. You know, I learned a long time ago that for every problem we have in life, there's also opportunities that those problems create.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking here about how to organize what I call the Middle East peace groups in not just Washington but throughout the country. Could this very flashpoint and explosive issue of Silouan and the home demolitions and so on possibly be a sort of a rallying point that could finally bring many Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Arab American, secular, et cetera, groups together, at least on this one issue where we would agree that, you know, this is a very toxic, very, very explosive idea, and we've got to do everything we can to stop it. And then who knows, from doing that, maybe other good things might happen. What do you think of that?
God bless you. I think you're right on the money. Look, you know, Jerusalem has this reputation for being nitroglycerin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every random bump in the road is going to set it off. That's nonsense. Jerusalem's a very stable city. And for me, the quintessential scene in Jerusalem is every Friday afternoon in the road coming down from Damascus Gate, corner of St. Stephen's Road at the third station of the cross. Every Friday afternoon, you'll see the following. Thousands of Jewish worshippers going to the Western Wall, thousands of Muslim worshippers going to pray at the mosques on Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount, and every Friday afternoon the Franciscans in their brown robes bearing the cross in the footsteps of Jesus towards Golgotha. There's no funding from the EU on a people-to-people project. There are no loudspeakers with a small world after all, and when people look at one another, it's more often with an element of disdain or contempt, but the damn thing works. Jerusalem is the counter-paradigm of clash of civilizations. That is something that Jerusalem has been doing for 1,300 years, and that's what Jerusalem can continue to do if handled responsibly. That is the Jerusalem paradigm. Over the next several years, one of two things are going to happen. The hemorrhaging interface between Islam, the Arab world, and the West, as disclosed in Beirut and Baghdad and Kabul, will begin to poison the water table of Jerusalem, and we will look more like Baghdad and Beirut, or Jerusalem will be able to demonstrate that there is room in the Middle East for elements of tense but stable pluralism and coexistence, not romantic coexistence, but coexistence. And that is eminently possible. For years, we've been told, don't touch Jerusalem, it's too radioactive, it's too difficult. The message that you implied, and which I accept, is as counterintuitive as this may sound, Jerusalem is the easiest place to start. And if the Obama administration is interested in sending message of new alignments and new interactions between the West, the Jewish Christian world, the Arab world, Jerusalem's the easiest place to start.
I would like to thank Danny Zeidman very, very much. So thanks again to Danny, and thanks for everyone who joined us on this conference call. This brings the call to an end. I would just like to remind you before we finish that the recording of this call will be posted shortly on our website for you to use and to send to friends and colleagues. Thanks again, Danny, and goodbye.
Good night.